Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
Hello, I'm Roger Watterson. During the next 3 weeks, we shall be visiting all of the constituencies in the 2011 general election for the House of Keys. Each weekday, Beth Espy and I shall be talking to the candidates, exploring and sometimes challenging their ideas, policies, beliefs, as they declare them in their manifestos and letters, and listening to them discussing amongst themselves the issues of the day to try and discover why they believe their constituents should invest a vote in them. Today, in the first of 15 programmes, we shall go to the far north and the constituency of Ayr, where three are contesting for one seat. The format of the programme will follow the traditional style where each candidate is invited to talk for up to 2 minutes, uninterrupted, on any topic of their choice before we enter into discussion. Each constituency has its own distinct personality, local issues, priorities, and in some, age or ethnic balance. Dan Walker has been taking a look at what makes Ayr tick.
Let us turn now to the most northerly of all the Isle of Man's constituencies, Ayr, a place famous for its terns and plovers and lapwings and oyster catchers. But it's not just the nature reserve at the island's most northerly tip. The constituency stretches down through Bride, skirts Ramsey and climbs up the TT course to the Isle of Man's highest point at Snae Fell and onto the Bungalow before turning sharply north towards the coast of Blue Point. At 2,192 voters, at least according to the last census, some of the flocks of birds which visit the former gravel pits probably outnumber the electorate. But for all that, it's a constituency which has punched above its weight in Manx history. Exotic place names such as Bolivia Mount and Nassau Road shine a light on the area's past when many retired sea captains chose to make their homes in the north. Thoreau Cottage remembers a dashing French privateer and smuggler, a terroriser of British shipping in the Seven Years' War, who fought and lost a naval battle off Ramsey in 1760. Prior to 2004, Edgar Quine was the voice of the North in the island's parliament. Mr. Quine held sway from 1986 when he ousted current president of Tynwald, Clare Christian, in a contest which saw a turnout of over 80%. 20 years later, the contrast couldn't have been more different as the current incumbent was returned unopposed in 2006. Such issues as landfill and the perennial question of work outside of Douglas have dominated local policy debates in the past. So what will the member starting work on the 30th of September have to contend with? Landfill is, to a large extent, consigned to the dustbin of history as the incinerator, energy from waste plant, guzzled most of the island's output. The refuse issue has been further clarified by a vote in Tynwald in June to approve plans for a new £1 million amenity centre at Balladool Farm on the Bride Coast Road. The question of jobs outside Douglas is one which vexes many communities on the island, but Ayr, with its scattered hamlets and farmsteads, suffers the most from long commutes and no direct link to the capital. Even the biggest villages in the constituency, Bride and Andrus, lack large employers, so it's inevitable that they look to their nearest neighbour, Ramsey, for work. With the marina and Queen's Pier plans on hold, it might be a case of wait and see for the new member.
That was Dan Walker taking a brief look at the constituency of Ayr. Now to the candidates, and in alphabetical order, as they will appear on the voting paper. Pat Ayres is standing as Liberal Vannon and is a semi-retired transport manager. Andrew Newington Bridges has been in local authority politics in the Isle of Man and has had a career in manufacturing, marketing and sales. And Eddie Teer, who became MHK for Ayr in 2004 after a career in banking. He has been minister at the DHSS and for education. Well, now it's time to hear what they have to say for and about themselves. We do this also in alphabetical order, starting with Pat Ayres. Your 2 minutes, please, Pat.
Thank you very much, Roger. Good evening. My name is Pat Ayres. I'm 56 and a widower. I live in Ramsey at present. I've been on the island full-time since 2003, although I've had a 10-year run-up to moving over here properly. First visited in 1959 with my parents, when just a little baby. I don't remember much of it, but I know I enjoyed it because I kept coming back. previously, politically, I've had various positions in Sussex on Hove Borough Council and East Sussex County Council. And then I moved to the Midlands of England to Nottinghamshire County Council, Nashville District, where I'd served a happy 10 years as a local councillor there. In amongst the jobs I had, were chair of planning, chair of information technology, and I took through the whole remuneration issue for the councillors to sort out the vast amounts of money they were being paid. I've acted as a residential social worker and trained in such and youth work. I've been a foster carer in both counties, and I worked for Notts Police for a time in a non-uniform capacity. I'm a member of the Liberal Vanning Party, and I have been for the past 4 years now. I worked with Peter Caron closely in his office at Tynwald for 3 years. I've helped draft the manifesto and the policies of the party. I believe that if you elect me to the Ayr constituency, with being part of the team of Liberal Vanning Party, we will make a vast difference to this island and hopefully sort out some of the problems we have.
That was Pat Ayres. Now it's the turn of Andrew Newington Bridges.
Good evening, Roger. Good evening. My name is Andrew Newington Bridges. I've lived on the island for some 22 years. I originally came here, actually in 1971, and fell in love with the island. It unfortunately took me another 18 years to actually get to live here. I believe that we live in the most cherished nation in the world. I fear that unless we fight rather better than we have of late, we are in grave danger of losing all of the best elements that the Isle of Man has. Our track record of the outgoing administration has been poor in the international scene. Having said that, we are the envy of all of our near neighbours. There isn't a society close to the Isle of Man that is in as good a position as we are. However, if we do not work at maintaining our position, we're going to find us sliding ever closer to the problems that face our near neighbours. I would like to believe that we can start negotiating with a far better and stronger voice in not only in Westminster, but also in Europe, so that we are not forever taking on board policies, laws, that we can't actually see any good for the island.
Right, that was Andrew Newington Bridges. Now we turn to Eddie Teer.
Good evening, I'm Eddie Teer. I'm one who's prepared to lead from the front. As chairman of the Manx Electricity Authority, I didn't take any pay, and last year I took a 10% pay cut. I feel that I have a good track record, both with staff bodies, and I am an effective manager who can drive forward strategy. Experience does count. This is not the time to learn on the job. At the Manx Electricity Authority, when I left, the business was trading £16 million ahead of budget. The headcount had been reduced by 17%, and we'd renegotiated the Bord Gáis air and gas contract, which has now led to savings of £1.5 million a year. Our profits from sales of gas to the UK had gone up from £170,000 a year to £3 million a year. At the Department of Health and Social Security, I brought in the nursing care contribution, reforms to various benefits, and brought in the breast screening call and recall. I also brought in the cataracts waiting list initiative, which has been of considerable benefit to a large number of patients. At education, I have managed to reduce our central expenses by £400,000, which enables us to keep more frontline staff. Government as a whole has made determined effort to reduce its expenditure, and in cash terms, our expenditure is down £30 million in 2 years. And in the current year, it is not anticipated that there will be any call on reserves. In summary, my party members are the people of Ayr. I have supported them on the Bride Tip, the Permitted Development Order, the new Civic Community Site, the new EMI Centre, and also the substantial investment in the Ramsey Cottage Hospital. We need people who can do, not people who say they can do.
Well, the last to speak there was Eddie Tier. Well, now we move on to the issues of the day, as the three candidates for Ayr see them to be. And we'll start a discussion now, which is an open forum. All the candidates here can chip in, talk about what they would like to talk about. But there are one or two issues which I must ask you as we go along, because they are raised by your manifestos, so, and also by your letters. I'll explain the phrase letters and why I ask that later. But perhaps we should go in backwards order, first of all. Now, Eddie Tier, after the trauma of the past few years, and I'm sure you would agree with me that it hasn't been an easy time in government, and there is a certain degree of public, I wouldn't say necessarily hostility, but certainly a public concern over the events of the past few years, you still want to go back for more. Why is that?
Some would say I'm a masochist, but I feel that there's unfinished business. I've done a considerable amount, and I'm now wanting to do more. I feel that we can do more, and that my track record does demonstrate that I am able and have the ability to do so.
But now, let me ask you then to identify what you think will be the most important matter. We can list dozens of different items, but what comes top of your list for the next 5 years?
One thing that we cannot avoid, we have to balance our books. We have to have a balanced budget by law, and this is going to be the top priority over the next 5 years.
What would you do in the next 5 years, Andrew Newington Bridges, if you had to write a shopping list? What would go to the top of it?
I think we're all likely to say the same thing, aren't we? That the biggest problem facing the island is that of finances, which have, in the main, the problems that we have been imported. They aren't self-made problems. And the shopping list, as you describe it, we have to start looking at not just the easy savings. We need to actually be looking at the overheads of government. And whilst I heard Mr. Tier just say that we've reduced our costs by some 30 million, that doesn't look like a tremendous amount against the 190 million. Obviously, these figures can be slightly juggled, that we're going to end up with in 2 to 3 years from now.
Well, I think we need to get these figures right, Roger, because it's not 190 million. It's 175 million.
Still a lot of money, no?
It's a lot of money, but we need to remember too that our gross expenditure is 881 million.
But as but Andrew is talking about, if I understand him there, Andrew, I'm not trying to put words into your mouth, but you're talking about balancing the books. But what are you saying? Talking about creating income or creating savings? Is it the savings you're criticising or the income making?
We've certainly got to. There isn't going to be a magic wand to solve our problems, and it has to be a combination of both. You've got to make savings on the overhead structure.
I think we need to explore that.
It's interesting that Mr. Tier corrects my figures, but the figures that I'm using are ones that have been used by government in the past, and now they've changed to 175 million, as though that was a massive improvement. But I repeat, against the 30 million that we've saved so far, we've still got a great distance to travel to get our account back into balance.
Right. Now, I have to ask the double-edged question now of Pat Ayres. What's your personal top of your shopping list, Pat, and what would be the top of the Liberal Vannins list? Is it the same thing?
Well, to quote Bill Clinton, it's the economy. I won't use the last word. Obviously, we need to do something about the economy. I'm glad Eddie stepped in and corrected the figures. The first thing you've got to do to try to look at it and try to find solutions is to get your numbers right so we know exactly where we're working from. Eddie knows it's being in government. I know it by attending Tynwald nearly more or less every week. He's on Ann Keys. We see each other every week as much as we can. We've got to see what there is that we can shave off of the expenditure. There are things we can shave off. We can look at the amount of personnel. We can look at restructuring departments, restructuring government to a degree. We can look at moving people around. We rent, that is the Isle of Man government, rent a number of buildings in Douglas at exorbitant rates. There must be other buildings that can be used around the island to help to save some money in that area. And it also saved travel for the employees. To a degree, it could go towards this 15-15, you know, reducing our carbon emissions by 15% by 2015. You know, we're doing woefully little to do, to achieve that now. I think that could go some way towards
it. There's a danger, isn't it, that there's a political wish list and you try and do everything and end up by doing nothing.
Agreed.
I mean, what if elected, what would be the, coming back to the question, what would be the first thing that you would try to do when you went into the House?
Is reorganise and restructure government properly and take, and we'll be looking at the scope and restructure of government report.
We would be looking.
We, the party.
There's an assumption there that there are a number of you that are elected.
There are a number. There will be a number of us elected. There's not enough of us to form the government, but there's certainly been enough of us to influence the government and influence policy.
Now, Pat's restructuring of government, Eddie, it's not new on the agenda, that. It came out before the last general election. It seemed to be judiciously ignored for such a long time.
Part of it has been implemented because a key recommendation was a department to drive the economy forward, economic development, and that has been done. Other areas are still a work in progress, and I would certainly agree that after the next election, the scope and structure of government will have to be reviewed again. But to pick up Mr. Eyre's point about downsizing to new buildings or new offices outside the Douglas area, that's fine. But in effect, what you're doing is you'd only be saving at the margins, because the rental for a property in Douglas is in the region of £20 a square foot. Outside, it's about 15. So £5 a square foot, you're not talking about big figures. And two, you've got to ask the staff to move as well, which isn't exactly easy at times.
There is, of course, the consideration that's been brought up on numerous times about the effect, both positive and negative, on the infrastructure of Douglas. I mean, shift people out, you shift the economic and shopping value of the people who visit the town down, but you and reduce the rate value to the town, but at the same time you alleviate the traffic problem.
You do. You've also got to consider the effect on, as you say, the economy. But in terms of Douglas, for example, there is a shortage of office space for the private sector, so it would free up space for the private sector if you found somebody to take over your lease commitments. But otherwise, you would still have your liability for an existing lease commitment.
Talking about relocating government departments, Andrew, is that just to be a detail? Is it a red herring, or is there some value in it?
I think it's actually very little value. I think there is an argument that we over-centralise in Douglas and therefore create some of the infrastructure problems that we now face. But having said that, centralising government departments and so on is almost a prerequisite to separate various organs of government outside of Douglas. Makes it very much more difficult from an administration point of view. Could I come back to Eddie Tear's point on the reduction? Because I'm interested that I've been given the figures by government that the 140 million that the UK came for 2 years ago has actually been reduced because of the increase in VAT from 17.5% to 20%. And the government figure I was given was 114 million that has been reduced down to. And we now have the second grab by United Kingdom government of 75 million, which of course is unaffected by the change in the VAT rate, since that's come in after the change. We're leaving out of these figures also, I don't think Mr. Tear is taking into account, the loss that this administration suffered of a further 25 million when Mr. Brown, as then Chancellor in the UK, changed the rate from 17.5% to 15%. Without, I understand, having spoken to a number of ministers, without any reference to the Isle of Man before that was actually carried out. So it's another 25 million that has also been lost under this last administration.
Well, let me suggest to you, however, that whatever these figures are, and whatever the final balance is, a lot of money has been lost to the revenue of the Isle of Man by this method over the past few years. Now, this is historic now, is it not? I mean, shouldn't we now be concentrating on what we do now to safeguard our position?
Well, perhaps Mr. Tyr can actually confirm whether the last 75 million has actually now been signed off, because I have information that it has not yet been signed off by the UK government.
The papers are ready to be signed, but as was mentioned by...
So you are agreeing that they're not signed off,
Mr. Treasury Minister, they would be signed. The negotiation has been done.
Is this left not to be signed up until the new House takes place?
I've no idea of the individual circumstances.
Because there was an argument, wasn't there, that the House, that the outgoing House should not commit the incoming House to this particular arrangement.
There was the argument, but as I say, government is there to govern.
Well, do you agree with that, Pat, that this particular VAT deal, however much pressure the Isle of Man was under, should have been delayed as a decision for the new House?
I don't think there's a way out of it, the new deal at the moment. It's been negotiated over a fair time by Mrs. Crane and Mr. Bell and other people. I don't think there's a way to get out of it. What we have to do is to look at, just in case they come back for another grab at us, and I'm of the opinion they may well do, what we need to do now is start negotiation away from that situation developing.
On what basis would the negotiation take place, and what strengths and weaknesses would be present there? Because there's an argument that throughout the last period there was a negotiating weakness. Would you agree with that, or is that just
We're weak, or the British government are weak?
I'm talking about here.
Yeah. Negotiating skills on this island aren't tip-top. Usually the government bring in consultants to do the negotiation, to do the research for them. It's a shame, because there are people on this island that can do it, if only they were brought into government to help out. The deal we've got at the moment, I think, I have to say, we've done pretty well to get it split over 3 years, so it's not one big hit of 75, it's divided down, and we can slowly grow into it, hoping that once we've got some policies in place to cut back on expenditure and wastage, that £40 million first tranche, we can actually probably not increase our income, but decrease our expenditure to allow for that, and the same for the subsequent 2 years.
One of the problems with government, Eddie, is that things, even good things that happen, seem to take so long to occur. Do we have time to do what Pat's saying, to look at it, to negotiate, to manoeuvre? I mean, is the negotiating time available? Are we back against the wall now?
We need to be on the front foot. We need to. There's three prongs of action here. The first is to clarify exactly what's our due share. The second part of it is to...
Is this a renegotiation you're talking about now?
No, not a renegotiation, because basically, what is our fair share? What would we generate if we had VAT on our own account?
How have we gone into these negotiations, Mr. Tyr, without knowing that?
Well,
how do you have meaningful negotiation without knowing what the figures are?
Well, if you had have realised that a large part of the trading on the Isle of Man is conducted by off-island companies.
Of course now, we know that.
Right, and then you'll also appreciate that their VAT arrangements are conducted through their parent companies in the UK. So whatever sales they make on the island are aggregated, or they're amalgamated with the UK figures.
I repeat the question, Mr. Tyr. How do you go into negotiations without knowing what the figures are? And you would have read the same document that I have read from Mrs. Crane, which actually says that the last 75 million that the UK government is now claiming is an excess, was actually, that figure was generated by the UK government on their estimates of the Manx economy. How can that possibly be in the interests of this island, that we allow a deal to go forward based on UK's estimates rather than our own figures?
No, it's our common estimates. Now,
Crane says. No,
if you just listen for a moment, you're talking about estimates. Their estimates are estimates, and there has to be common ground meeting between the two. What I'm saying is that we don't have the firm data, and at least now we have a firm arrangement in terms of the monetary value we'll receive over the next 2 years, so we have firm figures to work for. So if there was a double dip recession in the UK,
but
the amount of VAT take went down, we have a guaranteed figure.
I don't think Andrew is arguing about that you have the figures in front of you now. What he's saying is, how did you get to those figures in the first place? It seems you did that without sufficient information.
No, we did it on the deal of our best estimate. But what I'm saying is that we don't have accurate data, because the data is not in our possession. So over the next 2 years, that data needs to be collated.
What about external influences on the Isle of Man then, Pat? I mean, what's the Liberal Venon Party's view on this? We seem to be under pressure very often to do things from the United Kingdom. We've only recently been discussing the pressure to remove the ARRI tax certificate system. We've had to abandon meat derogation. There's a whole catalogue of things that you go back over the ages. And EU influence, of course, is there continually. I mean, do you accept that as a Crown dependency we just have to put up with this, or has the party got a view on it?
No, I don't. We do not need to put up with the pressures we're being put under. What we're saying, we should rejoin EFTA, the European Free Trade Association, which, when England, or UK, shall I say, join the EU, unlike us.
And can we do that under our existing EU arrangements?
Well, we don't need the EU to do it. We can start negotiations with the European Free Trade Association to rejoin. We only came out of it when Britain joined the EU. I don't know why we came out. We should have stayed there. But we can start negotiation re-entry, and there we can take back more control over our markets.
But then would that mean we come away from VAT?
That is something that's part of the discussions.
Well, because otherwise we'd lose the 10% direct trading into the European Union that we have. We've put our manufacturing sector in jeopardy.
Well, I personally think that they need us more than we need them.
I admire your confidence.
Well,
do you have a view on that, Andrew?
I actually, without the benefit of facts, and I still can't believe that we went into those negotiations. Perhaps Mr. Tier can clear up another point on this, is that 2 years ago we were told by the British government that we were getting too much out of the agreement and they wanted to redraw the balance, and that resulted in 140 million. How is it that 2 years later we haven't now resolved that situation, but they say it's still wrong and they want more money? And they changed then the basis of calculation. This year's negotiation, I call it this year's because obviously, unlike Mr. Tier, I only have the information when it becomes in the public domain. And this year's negotiation is based on a changed way of calculation. Were we told about that change before we went in to that last set of negotiations, or was it dropped on us when we got there?
Well, could I just do a bit of history here? In 1979, long before Mr. Newington Bridges set up home on the island, the original revenue sharing agreement was put in place. Now, at that time, we had a reasonable tourist sector and a very small finance sector. If we roll on 32 years, we have a tourist sector, which is about 5% of the economy, and a finance sector, which is 36% of the economy. So our finance sector is out of kilter. Why is that important? Because the finance sector in the main generates very little VAT. So we have a big sector of our economy which generates very little VAT. And that's the cause of the issues here. Because when we started the original revenue sharing agreement, our economy was very similar in its composition to the UK. Now it's completely divergent.
Well, would you agree with me then that one of the problems in all of this is, leaving aside the issues itself, is the way that the previous administration has communicated with the public and the people. I mean, despite the fact there's been a great deal of press releases and information, the message does not seem to have got over, does it?
Well, I'm not criticising the media. What I'm saying is radio tends to deal with the immediate issues and set the scene. The written word now tends to look for articles between 350 and 500 words. And in those sort of articles, it's impossible to get over the depth of the argument.
I don't know if that's the argument Roger's actually putting forward there. I kind of got from Roger's question, he's looking more at the information coming from government.
That is the point I was making.
That's
yes.
The point Roger's making. So, sorry, did you totally misunderstood the question? Maybe a bit too defensively.
No, I didn't, because the information does go out. but it's up to our journalists and media whether they pick it up on that.
I have to say it does sometimes go out, but there is a feeling sometimes that it's not necessarily issued to inform, but it's issued to persuade to the opinion of whoever's issued it.
Well, that's so, your view, Roger,
yes,
certainly.
So what I'm trying to get at is, if you want people to be on your side, should not the communication between the government and the public, should not that be better, whichever means you use?
Well, I think a good illustration of that was during my time at the Department of Health and Social Security. We went around the island on a series of roadshows, a question and answer session. I, as the minister, set the scene, spoke for between 1/4 hour and 20 minutes, and then threw it open to questions from the floor. And that went down very well because we had the opportunity to explain to people in more depth and to address their concerns.
How do you react to the issue of information then, Andrew? I mean, you're talking about information there. You've done your homework, so you must be able to get at this information.
I'm actually concerned. I have to go back, Roger. I asked a fairly simple question of Mr. Tier, which he then gave us a historical background and actually... Just so Mr. Tier knows, I've actually been on the island since 1971 and coming here on a regular basis. It's only that I lived here 22 years ago, so I am familiar with what happened in 1979. I asked you a simple question, Mr. Tier, and that was, did we go into these negotiations knowing that they were changing the basis of calculation? And you haven't answered me.
No, I haven't answered you because basically, when you go into negotiations, you never know which way it's going to turn.
No, that wasn't the question, Mr. Tier. Did you know when you went into those negotiations that they were going to change the terms?
That's the way that negotiations know.
I think we've got up a blind alley here at the moment, Andrew, because I don't think we're going to get the answer
only getting a political answer.
Can we move on then?
We're politicians.
Existing system. Now, there is a view by many that the Isle of Man's political system, warts and all, still works very effectively for us. But now, Pat, you've joined and you are part of a Liberal Vannan party which has fielded 10 candidates during this election. What on earth can a party bring to bear that years, if not centuries, of political history has already done and achieved?
Years and centuries of political history has been very good. Very good. Unfortunately, the last 7 years haven't been so good. We've seen not a dictatorship, but a lack of understanding of what the people want from the Chief Minister for the past 5 years, who, at the end of the day, was a compromise candidate anyway. Nobody wanted him originally, and he was the best of the worst. As a party, we see that there needs to be a consistent approach. People need to see, and they can see, what our policies are, and what our constitution is, before we even go to the polls. They only have to visit the website. They will begin our manifesto in the next week or so, which is now at the printers as we speak, as you well know. And they will see teamwork. If one of us is lacking in one area, I mean, I'm not a financial expert, but we have members that are financial experts.
We have 10 candidates.
Yes.
So not all of them may be elected. No. So where does that leave if there's just one or two of you?
I don't know how many there will be, obviously. I predict we'll have at least 6 in the House. And that leaves us as the power group. We will have a grouping of power there. We can influence policy.
Six out of 24 is a power group?
Yes, 25% of the House.
Right. But how would a group of that nature translate combined policies as opposed to individual policies of the candidates, independents like our two colleagues here, from a wish list into something practical?
Because we've set our policies out already. We've been speaking about them for the past 2 years. What we aim to do. We've got things on culture change. We want to maintain competitive tax rates, improve performance. Strategic lifelines to be maintained. We've got all these policies in place now. They're all written down. People have been reading them through the Manx Guardian, through our manifesto, through the letters we've been dropping, various other things, and from our website.
One of the powers of a member of the House of Keys, or one of the facilities available to him as an independent, is that he has to use all the powers of his persuasion. He can't actually force anything through. He has to persuade others to come with him.
That's not true. Tony Brown himself sat in the House last year and said the MEA shops will not be shut. There was no discussion. He just dictated that.
So
that isn't democracy.
Let's presume that there are a number of you elected. Will you actually take part in government? We're all talking about here now about the need to work together, the need to, you know, safeguard the future.
Yeah.
Are you going to actually take part this time, or do as indeed seemed to happen the last time and sit on the sidelines and have a snipe?
No. Even Peter Cowan doesn't sit on the sidelines and have a snipe. He sits there and he asks questions that need to be asked.
So will you take part?
We will take part, of course, in running the island. What we have said and what our constitution says, we will not take a government position until, and people purposefully leave the second bit out, until we're in such a position to influence policy decisions.
So
there's a vast difference. We will work with and alongside, but not in.
So
government.
Will you be allowed to think for yourselves in a party structure, or will you have to take directives from the party executive?
I've always thought for myself. We've got core policies which we follow, which we'll adhere to. You can have a core policy, but it's more than one way to skin a cat. Well, I mean, we want performance improvements, and that's laid out in our policy document. How we go about that, that is where the negotiation starts. That is where we can maybe go off piste to a certain degree, and we can wander around and find out what will count. But the core policy will always be there.
Right. Now, we'll have to take a break in just a moment or two, but I'd just like to ask the other two gentlemen here. Pat's making a case for a change in circumstances in the Manx political scene, and we've heard a lot of talk in the past about the block vote of the Council of Ministers and others, which was alleged as a form of party structure in the end. Is it about time, Andrew, then, that perhaps we should succumb and we should adopt party policies and party politics?
No. I don't think that in a group of 24, because it's no good saying, well, we just have one party. It will lead to, if you go down the party route, to several parties. And so we will have a fraction argument with the very real risk that no decisions will ever be made, because there is always a political argument party to party. I'm also concerned that I want individuals elected that actually have their own views, rather than having to go back to some central think tank as to what their views might be on a particular issue.
What do you think about that, Eddie? I mean, same question, really. Times have changed. Other small communities, such as Gibraltar, support a fairly aggressive party system.
Jersey.
Is it about time that we do?
No, I don't, because basically I feel that one of the strengths of the Isle of Man system is that the representatives from the community do reflect the constituency. And certainly in Ayr, you have a rural constituency, and I feel the members over the years have tended to reflect the composure and the makeup of that constituency. The biggest danger is with a political party. Most of the members would be in the urban areas, and they would be dictating policy, which might not be relevant for a rural area.
Well, at this point in our discussion, we'll take a short commercial break. Don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
And welcome back to this, the first in the series of election 2011 constituency programmes, in which, with a political eye, we take a look at Ayr and its three candidates, Eddie Tier, Andrew Newington Bridges and Pat Ayres, who's from the Liberal Van Enn Party. We touched on party policies there and sort of the basic questions that people are more to the point, party politics, and the questions that people very often answer, Pat. But let's now just deal with some of the issues that are coming out in Ayr as you're going around, and some of the matters that you think are important. Now, if I go back to you again, Pat, if, we talked about your shopping list before, but I noticed in the Liberal Van Enn's manifesto, a whole section deals quite detailedly with freedom of information and general information.
Huh.
Why is that? I mean,
because it's lacking. The past 5 years have been very lacking. There's things go on in this government. Decisions are made behind closed doors. They're not made in public. And Eddie will probably argue that they are all made in public. Well, I'd question that straight away. But not having the information that Eddie's got, obviously, you know, I can't prove it right at the moment.
How will the Freedom of Information help that, though? Because,
well, it'll enable us. I mean, the last Freedom of Information Act that Tony Brown very cleverly put forward in the last possible meeting, knowing full well it wouldn't get passed just to fulfil an election promise. If you actually read that, it wasn't very good. any information pertaining to government could be vetoed by the Chief Minister, by the Speaker or the President. That isn't freedom of information. That is pretty dreadful in my book. What we need is a proper, robust freedom of information. So that if we want to find out what a consultant's report said, for instance, the steam packet report that has been shelved, stuck under a drawer, wherever it's been put, but we're not going to see it, that's for sure. There must be some dynamite in there. But we'd be able to get hold of that just by asking for it. We would see... Look, I haven't finished it, Ellie. Just a moment. We would see, be able to see the steam packet user agreement without having to sit in the library and read it with somebody watching us doing it and not allowed to take pictures, copies or even write notes. That's the kind of freedom of information we're talking about.
But doesn't this freedom of information legislation in any country come with some caveats on it? There are still people who can say, for whatever the reasons, like national interest or security, that you can't have it.
That goes without saying. We don't want to go down the line of WikiLeaks. There are certain things you have to protect people that are in vulnerable positions. You have to protect some business dealings because it's ongoing business. And to just put it out in the general public, if it's a contract, for like... We need to see all the tenders for the Summerland Hotel, Bistro, whatever's going to end up there, car park. That would not be viable during negotiations.
I suppose,
but afterwards they could be released.
There's a reasonable question there, Eddie. Freedom of information was certainly high on the agenda at the last general election, and here we are talking about it again now, 5 years later.
It is, but really, the scheme we have in place at the moment does deliver more openness and transparency. The Council of... Councillor Ministers' minutes are published on a regular basis. That's been done for the first time.
Unedited?
But the topics are there, so people know what's being discussed.
It says in the Green Book that they don't take minutes at Councillor Ministers' meetings, and all decisions in Councillor Ministers' meetings are not made by vote, they're made by consensus. See, you're not giving us the correct information
We are, because the...
It's in the standing orders.
The information is there. No, you're confusing it. That's the standing orders of Tynwald. The Green Book is the standing orders of Tynwald. It's nothing to do with the Council of Ministers. You've got parliamentary and then you've got the executive.
There's a whole section in there on how Council of Ministers is run. There's a whole section in that Green Book, is there not, of how Council of Ministers meetings are run.
Not in the Tynwald.
So let's clarify this then. Does the Council of Ministers actually have a majority vote?
The Council of Ministers will have a majority vote. It goes round the table. What's your view? What's your view? Very open. And
it's a recorded vote.
That's the decision. No, the overall opinion is recorded, but if somebody if somebody has a major issue with it, they can record a dissent.
Okay.
So that's fine. But what I'm saying is we've got to recognise that in some instances it's commercial confidentiality. And if you take the space industry, for example, some of the information that's got out has encouraged our rivals to move forward. For example, we're now coming under pressure from Bermuda, Gibraltar and the UK, who are now trying to muscle in on the act.
That was to be expected anyway, though, wasn't it? It always happens with any...
It wasn't, but why give them the information which we worked hard to secure?
Okay.
It's shooting ourselves in both feet.
But isn't that part of the restricted information that would come out? I mean, do you agree that there is a need for some sort of information act for the general
public? Well, I'm saying that there is a high level of disclosure of information now. There's been four instances where the government has been challenged. When that went to the Deemster to make an independent assessment of it, the Deemster ruled in three of the cases against the government. Now, that illustrates, too, that the judiciary is not under the control of the executive.
Right. Now, Andrew, I noticed that in your document, which you do not call a manifesto, you call it a list of your beliefs, it's sort of a catechism, isn't it, of your political... views there. You say in one part you're quite critical about the fact that the Alabama government uses a lot of and employs a lot of consultants for a whole variety of purposes, but you seem to imply that they're not being held to account. But is that fair?
Well, one again can only go on the information that is made available publicly, and we were told on the island, and certainly Eddie Tier and myself were around at that time on IRIS, and we were told that this was an all-island sewerage system. Well, we now know it isn't an all-island sewerage system, and that we are going to have to put in treatment works in the north of the island, and we're also going to have to put a treatment works over in Peel. so that the all-island scheme, as was promoted originally, is no more. And now the costs are going to go up with now having to have three treatment works instead of one.
So what are you suggesting? No.
That is wrong. The IRIS scheme was originally formulated 25 years ago. Technology moves on. And now the latest figures prove that by having separate treatment plants, it's cheaper. It's cheaper in capital costs and cheaper in operating costs. And Mr. Newington Bridges is really saying we should have stuck with what we agreed 25 years ago.
No, that's not what... Don't put words into my mouth, Mr. Tier. That's not what I said at all.
That's the inference of what
I said. I said that those who are responsible for giving advice which then proves doesn't work should be held responsible.
I'm not saying that it didn't work. You're saying that it didn't work. And what I'm saying is that you cannot base all decisions on something which was given to you 25 years ago.
I think we've got hooked on a particular scheme there. I think the principle is that the government employs a lot of consultants and acts very often on his advice which is paid quite heavily for at times. But when that advice turns out to be faulty, what's the comeback? Do we ever have a comeback?
Because ever fight our corner?
Well, I have a live issue at the moment which will well go to court.
So you do fight back with consultants?
Oh, right. Yes, too right to do it, because if I take the view that if they take the Queen's shilling, they are responsible, they fight in the trenches.
When we were talking about that then, Pat, you were nodding.
I was agreeing with Eddie. The IRIS scheme was designed many years ago. The island's moved on, technology's moved on. The IRIS scheme, as designed, can't cope with the demand. That's plain and simple, we know that, and that is why there's other treatments apart being built, one being built up in Bride at the moment, one planned for Peel. The government obviously can't say the favoured site for that because that's quite contentious in other matters at the moment. But it has to be, is needing to be enhanced. So it is doing its job that it was designed for originally. Unfortunately, the island's outgrown it. But the one thing on the IRIS that I find quite shocking is the dryer. They're just spending millions on a drying machine to dry the sludge. And they're drying the sludge into nice little pellets, which is going to the truck, which is going to the incinerator.
Being burned.
I don't call it...
Going to the incinerator.
Well, it has to be dampened again, because otherwise it jams up the incinerator.
Okay.
And being burned. But, just one quick point on this, we're paying for that over 50 years, yet it's only got a design life of 25 years. That, to me, is fantasy stuff.
Right, now, we could explore that quite a lot, but we're going to have very short time now, and there's two things I'd like to do. Any good parliamentary system anywhere in the world, Eddie, relies on the quality of its leadership. Have we got, do you think, within Tynwald and with perhaps the core of the candidates at the moment, what's necessary for the new Chief Minister and the demands that are going to be put upon him this time round?
We always find people who will rise to the occasion, Roger.
But it doesn't answer the question, really, does it?
But that's the fact of life, Roger.
Right, so as far as Chief Minister this time is concerned, it will be a matter of positive leadership, won't it?
It'll be positive and proactive, and what I'd like to see too is a more inclusive style of leadership, because now we have completely different circumstances, and be it the Liberal Venant Party or whoever, everybody's opinion needs to be valued.
Now, if I were to say a similar sort of question to you, Andrew, about as far as leadership is concerned, what would you expect from the next Chief Minister? Would you expect the same as we've seen from all the previous incumbents in office? Or do you think the newcomer is going to have some special demands upon him?
I think that the Chief Minister's role has to be, and I actually agree with Eddie, that you actually have to have the right man for the circumstances of the time.
Or woman.
Or woman, not a sexist remark. But you need the right character in that role for the times that then face the island.
And
it's one of the worries that I have when we talk about making it popularly elected and so on. I can't see that as a possibility. It has to be from the members that actually can see who is, in their judgment, is going to be the right man.
So if you were elected and you were in the Keys and you had to choose a Chief Minister, what would come top of his qualities for you?
I think because, as I've said earlier, most of our problems are imported, the serious financial problems are imported, he's got to have skills that can actually go and negotiate in the international arena far better than we've seen of late.
OK, now, what would you look for? I'll have to ask you this quickly, but it's one more I'd like to ask you.
Well, I would look for in a chief minister, if I'm in a position to select one or help select one, is somebody that can work as part of a team, somebody whose IQ is higher than his ego. Past 5 years, we haven't had that, unfortunately. And there's some that are going for election this time, but I'm afraid have got extremely large egos. They're not team players.
Doesn't that have to go with the job to a degree, though?
What doesn't, sorry?
You have to have some ego to go with the job. It's a political requirement, isn't it, when you stand for office?
I think what you need to do is be prepared to take one for the team, basically. Tony Brown got a lot of stick, mostly deserved, but he still stood there and negotiated and he'd go to London and he'd stand there in public and say things that weren't popular. I'll give him credit for doing that.
Right, okay.
Unfortunately, I don't think he actually understood the question.
Right, now we've literally got just a couple of minutes to go, gentlemen, so we have to come back to the usual question. And I'll go back in the alphabetical order and I'll go to you, Pat, and say to you, people listening in air today who are going to be casting a vote in a few weeks' time, why should they invest their vote in you?
They should invest in me, because I live not in the constituency, but very close to it. I'm planning to move to the constituency. Houses aren't selling. I am part of a group of people whose first and prime interest is the welfare of the island, and my prime interest will be the welfare of the constituency.
Why should they vote for you, Andrew Newington Bridges?
Hopefully the electorate, when they consider the problems that we've faced over the last 5 years, will actually wish to see a representative locally who has a passion for the Isle of Man, and not to allow the introduction of totally unsuitable legislation into the island, which I haven't seen any of our previous political representatives holding well.
And Eddie?
I feel that I have an impressive track record. I've demonstrated that I can take the pressure, I can take unpalatable decisions, and because I'm always out and about, I go to lots of local events, I understand the community. I've been part of the community for many, many years.
Well, gentlemen, we've run out of time, and it's here we must end our programme, in which we discussed the policies, beliefs and important issues of the day with three candidates contesting the single-seat constituency of Ayr. There were Pat Ayres, Andrew Newington Bridges and Eddie Teer. Tomorrow, at the same time, Beth Espy will travel to Castletown to meet the six candidates seeking election to the seat recently vacated by Tony Brown. And I'll be back on Wednesday with Douglas East. The programme was produced by Catherine Nicol and Mark Tiley. I'm Roger Watterson. Until we next meet, goodbye.